What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. An Islamic State attack north of Baghdad Sunday left at least 11 people dead, more than 20 others wounded. Suicide attackers stormed a gas plant and set off a car bomb. At least three storage gas containers were set afire. The latest attack follows others in the past week, including three in Baghdad that killed nearly 100 people. In Jordan Sunday, the Obama administration's top envoy to the coalition fighting IS extremists, Brett McGurk, said the Sunni insurgency has been unable to gain significant ground since taking the Iraqi city of Ramadi a year ago, which they lost in December to Iraqi security forces.
The caliphate, as they call it, this perverse caliphate, is shrinking. So they are very much on the defensive. They have not retaken any territory, really, since their operations in Ramadi going all the way back to May. So their territory is shrinking, and they are now doing these suicide attacks against civilian populations. It's not going to work, but that's what they're trying to do. But this is nothing new. It's not a new tactic. I mean, this is the nature of the organization.
McGurk told reporters in Amman the U.S.-led coalition is conducting precision airstrikes in Mosul almost daily, describing it as synchronized pressure. Gambia's President Yahya Jammeh Sunday said he will not negotiate a border dispute with Senegal, which surrounds his tiny country, raising doubts about whether a meeting will take place in Dakar. According to the French press agency, Mr. Jammeh said on state television he has no plans of settling the matter because his border remains open. In February, Gambia imposed a hike on fees for trucks entering the country from Senegal without advance notice. Senegalese truck drivers responded by blockading the border. Guinea's leader, President Alpha Conde, is trying to mediate the dispute. This is VOA News. In the Caribbean nation of Dominican Republic, early results from Sunday's election show incumbent President Danilo Medina poised to win re-election easily and avoid a runoff. With 15% of the vote counted, Mr. Medina held 61% of the ballot. He needs more than 50% to avoid a runoff. His nearest rival is businessman Luis Abinader with 35%. On Sunday, Mr. Medina indicated he would accept the results whatever they are. Voting Sunday was hampered by problems with new voter fingerprint technology and the sudden mass resignation of thousands of poll workers. Mr. Medina benefits from an economy that grew 7% last year, but more than 40% of the country's 10 million residents remain in poverty. The South American country Venezuela is in crisis a day after President Nicolas Maduro threatened to seize closed factories and arrest their owners. The country struggles to deal with food shortages, hyperinflation, protests, and power shortages. Friday, Mr. Maduro extended a state of emergency, accusing the U.S. of trying to destabilize his country. He has called for military exercises to combat foreign aggression, he said, has led to the country's current crisis. Mark Jones is a Rice University Latin expert.
It's rare to find a middle-income country that had been at such a high in terms of wealth, functioning democratic institutions, to see one now that is now experiencing conditions that you only see during times of war.
Mr. Maduro's political opponents have become increasingly vocal, calling on the president to step down this year. Almost 20,000 South Sudanese left UN camps since the end of last year, but over 180,000 remain. The Senior Coordination Officer for Relief, Reintegration and Protection, Sam Muhumuri, says they're being encouraged to return home.
You cannot live a dignified life in a POC site. So it's important that religious leaders, political leaders, as well as the traditional leaders, keep on talking to their people so that they can understand that they also have a contribution to make.
The UN World Food Program warns more than 5 million people in South Sudan may face a severe food shortage during the rainy April through September season, double the number of the first 3 months. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Sunday met in Riyadh with Saudi King Salman, seeking the kingdom's support in strengthening a cessation of hostilities in Syria. Saudi Arabia has been a key supporter of the rebels fighting to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad. Mr. Kerry travels to Vienna Monday, where he'll co-host a ministerial meeting on security and support for Libya. Hundreds of performers and horses Sunday culminated in a four-day event at Windsor Castle near London, marking Queen Elizabeth's 90th birthday. She's the longest-ruling British monarch with a reign extending 64 years. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbati in Washington. Today is Monday, May 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A new report exposes corruption involving bribes to top Liberian officials.
We had proof that the intention of those payments was to first get the law changed in order to second get to the big iron deal. And that was the advice given to the company by Sherman, by their lawyer.
Jonathan Gant is senior campaigner on Liberia for Global Witness. Meanwhile, the Liberian government wants all evidence provided so that it may investigate and prosecute those who will be found culpable. Nigeria has an anti-corruption summit to help recover stolen public funds. And Uganda's opposition leader charged with treason begins his fifth day today in prison.
We have not been given any details or particulars of what the charge is made of, because the police have not come up with any particulars or details of why, if it is true, he has been charged with treason.
George Kanyi Hamba is a former justice of the Ugandan Supreme Court. Cameroon and its allies are claiming gains in two operations against Boko Haram last week. And rights groups criticize Angola's government over imprisonment of 17 activists. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The London-based Global Witness organization has released a new report in which it alleges that over $950,000 in bribes and other suspicious payments were made to top Liberian officials by the UK-based Sable Mining Company and its Liberian lawyer, Varney Sherman. According to the report entitled The Deceivers, Sable wanted to get the concessional rights to Liberia's Wologizi iron ore. Councillor Sherman, who is also chairman of President Sirleaf's ruling Unity Party, allegedly told the company that in order to get the contract, it must first offer bribes to senior officials to change Liberia's concession laws. Mr. Sherman was not immediately available for comment, but he told the local print media that the report was a reckless disregard for the truth. But Jonathan Gant, senior campaigner on Liberia for Global Witness, says his organization stands by the report.
It's a collection of evidence that's actually taken quite a long time to put together. It's based upon leaked emails, both from the company and from the law firm itself, which included attachments listing the bribes and payments that were described in the press release and in the report. As far as the payments are concerned, we have proof that payments were made. We had proof that the intention of those payments was to first get the law changed in order to second get to the big iron deal. And that was the advice given to the company by Sherman, by their lawyer, that they should get the law changed in order to get the contract.
Councillor Sherman, Varney Sherman, gave a news conference on Friday in Liberia and described your report as a reckless disregard for the truth. Did you contact Mr. Sherman before writing your report?
Oh, yeah. No, it's definitely standard procedure for Global Witness prior to publication under UK law. So, yeah, we contacted him a number of times, both in order to try and make sure we were getting our facts straight, but then also to ensure that he had what is legally his right and also morally correct in order for him to have the opportunity to respond. I think we contacted him two times, maybe three. Not all the conversations were particularly long, as he usually refused to comment on the substance of any of the questions that we posed to him.
Who is Big Boy 1 and Big Boy 2 in your report?
We didn't put the names of those two individuals, just the names that were on the payment list that we had, which is Big Boy 1 and Big Boy 2, because we don't right now have the evidence to be able to state who those people actually are. So we know that the payments were made to one and two, but we can't say who one and two are. Don't get me wrong, we're certainly going through our evidence as hard and fast as we can to find out if it is publishable, but right now it's not.
The Liberian government has said that it is concerned about the what they call grave allegations made in your report and has therefore requested your organization to make available all the pieces of evidence on this matter so that it can take appropriate action to investigate and prosecute. Would you honor the Liberian government's request?
Of course. We wrote to the Liberian government before publishing the report, and again, following the announcement by the government on Thursday that it would be initiating a task force investigation, I believe, is what has been announced. And we will, of course, be cooperating. We'll be providing the information that we're able to provide to them.
Do you have confidence that the government of Liberia will investigate and prosecute?
I am confident that the government will investigate. As some of your listeners will be aware, the government has undertaken a series of investigations under the presidency of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and some of them have been very good. In 2012, there was an investigation into illegal logging licenses, lots of illegal logging licenses, and as a result of that investigation, which was quite thorough, most of those licenses were cancelled. There have been other investigations which have been less thorough and have not resulted in penalties against those who broke the law.
Jonathan Gant is senior campaigner on Liberia for Global Witness. He was speaking with me from London. The Liberian government has asked the London-based Global Witness to make available all evidence connected with its latest report, which alleges that Liberian officials received nearly $1 million in bribes from the UK-based Sibel Mining Company and its Liberian lawyer, Vani Sherman, to change the country's concessional laws. Minister of Information Eugene Nnamdi says the allegations in the report reflect badly on the image of Liberia, and the government wants to investigate and prosecute those who will be culpable.
We are taking this matter seriously. So the president has taken some steps, including the formation of a special task force to immediately investigate. And if there is culpability determined, for us to prosecute those who will be determined to have broken the laws of Liberia. So we are asking, we've communicated officially to Global Witness to adduce whatever documentary evidence they have so that they can assist us in investigating this matter and bringing it to a closure. In fact, as I speak to you, I've already received an email from Global Witness acquiescing to our request. They have committed to working with us, to cooperating, and to submitting all of the documents that they have so that we can carry out the investigation that needs to happen for us to get to the bottom of this.
Well, Mr. Minister, I think Global Witness named Councillor Vani Sherman. Vani Sherman is in Monrovia. Did your government contact Mr. Sherman?
Well, the report was released a couple of days ago, and right away the president constituted a special investigative task force, which has begun work. The president has also instructed the task force, because under our law, all Liberians are equal before the law. So every individual connected with this situation accused by Global Witness that have been named in this report will be interviewed by the task force, the prosecutors who will determine which course of actions to take. And we are very serious as a government to get to the bottom of this, because this matter touches on the image of our country, not just the image of the individual's name.
Mr. Minister, I don't know whether the Liberian people will have confidence in a committee being set up.
Firstly, let me say this generally. The Liberian people do have confidence in the government of Liberia, and they have shown that by electing the government twice. So we know the people have confidence, because the evidence is that they have confidence in the government. Now, you mentioned the PUP situation in the forest sector. Global Witness itself has acknowledged that following the report they had on the PUP, the government of Liberia took action and have prosecuted people. So the government has a record of getting to the bottom of these allegations and taking firm and concrete actions within the ambit of the law.
Eugene Nnamdi is Liberia's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Today is Monday, May 16th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Officials of Britain, the U.S., Nigeria, and other nations last week held what is seen by some analysts as a landmark summit in the global fight against corruption. But given strong financial interests in countries where corrupt officials stash their money, questions are being raised on whether the summit can change anything. VOA Europe correspondent Luis Ramirez reports from London.
It was anger over corruption in Tunisia that touched off the 2011 Arab Spring that spread to places like Syria and Libya, now hotbeds of extremism. For leaders meeting in London to tackle corruption, it is a matter of security.
We are fighting a battle, all of us, for our states, for our countries, for our nation state. Corruption writ large is as much of an enemy, because it destroys nation states, as some of the extremists were fighting.
This is where some of the stolen money historically has ended up. This area of central London is known to some as Red Square for its Russian-owned mansions. Britain's leader said the onus is on his country to act.
Why I think this matters so much is that I believe that corruption is the cancer at the heart of so many problems we need to tackle in our world.
10 years ago, summits like this would have focused on kleptocrats in the developing world. Anti-corruption campaigners saw this one as different. Rich countries took the blame.
We're really thinking about the providers of the financial secrecy that don't just facilitate but actively drive corruption of different sorts all around the world.
The leaders at the summit committed to expose and punish corruption. Cameron unveiled a plan to make public who the real owners of British registered companies are. Next comes the tough part.
The real issue, I think, for the UK is whether it can put together both global leadership, as the Prime Minister is showing here in London this week on this issue, with also ensuring that it's walking the walk and talking the talk itself.
Analysts say world leaders are worried about a loss of legitimacy that comes from seeing the rich and powerful evade taxes and get away with it. The London summit is a way to show that the political elite are doing something about it. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, London.
Cameroon and its allies in a multinational force are claiming gains in two operations last week against the Boko Haram militant group in Nigeria. Cameroonian casualties from the operations have reached hospitals, and as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Maroua, their morale remains high.
30 wounded Cameroonian soldiers have been ferried in the past 4 days to the military hospital in Maroua on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. Among them is 26-year-old Fabian Gore, who says he was wounded when his vehicle hit a landmine returning from the Nigerian town of Kumche after raids that destroyed 4 Boko Haram training camps.
While coming back, our vehicle claims on a mine. That is how we have this shock-based incident. From there, they brought me here. Now, we're having a difference. I'm feeling so happy. It's what we have been waiting since maybe from 2 months now, when my legs will get finished. I can wear my uniform and rangers or go back and continue my mission.
Joseph Amayadi, a 22-year-old soldier, is being treated for snake bites he says he received near the Boko Haram training center at Kumche. He told VOA at least 7 of his colleagues are missing.
Entre Gangse et Amchide, il y a eu explosion. On a perdu deux éléments.
He says they lost 2 of their colleagues in a loud explosion between Gangse and Amchide in Nigeria. He says he now feels better after receiving treatment at the military hospital and wants to go back to fight for his country. Saturday, the multinational force said 5 Boko Haram leaders were captured, dozens of militants were killed, and 60 women and children freed during the recent operations. Cameroon spokesperson Issa Chiruma said no soldiers were killed, but several were wounded. Defense official Kumpa Issa, who is in charge of caring for wounded soldiers, visited the hospital Sunday. He says even in rough field conditions, he is impressed with the rapid and professional care for the soldiers. A soldier's spokesperson, Abdoulaye Bello, said the wounded troops are ready to go back and defeat the terrorists. Cameroon says Gosse and Kumche on the Nigerian territory has been a training ground for suicide bombers, especially young women and girls. Moki Edwin Kinzeka. For VOA News, Maroua, Northern Cameroon.
In Uganda, a team of lawyers and officials from the party of jailed opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye will travel to Moroto town in the northeastern sub-region of Karamoja to visit Dr. Besigye, who has been jailed there. Besigye, the runner-up in the February 18 presidential election, was arrested last Wednesday in Kampala after he eluded the round-the-clock blockade and surveillance of his home. Also last Wednesday, a video purportedly showing Dr. Besigye being sworn in as the new president of Uganda was shown on YouTube and being shared on Facebook and other social media platforms. George Kanyihamba, former justice of the Ugandan Supreme Court, says he knows of no treasonable offense that Dr. Besigye has committed so far, just from purporting to be sworn in the social media.
Just before President Museveni was sworn in, something came on Twitter. We don't know how true it is or not, saying that Chief Besigye had gone through a form of swearing in. The picture shows a number of other people, Ugandans, who attended that, presumably, phantom ceremony. They were known. You would have expected that if he genuinely committed treason against the government of Uganda or the people of Uganda, that they also would be arrested. So they singled him out from that Twitter picture and took him into northern Uganda, in Karamoja. And then we hear, while he was there, he was charged with treason. We have not been given any details or particulars of what the charge is made of, because the police have not come up with any particulars or details of why, if it is true, he has been charged with treason.
There were allegations that Dr. Besigye or the FDC had an alternative swearing in of Dr. Besigye. Are you saying there's no evidence to that? And if there's evidence, is this something that is treasonable?
None at all. First of all, if at all he was sworn in, which nobody really has verified, if at all, there's no physical evidence that he was, except that which was on the social media. You can't be sworn in on social media. That's number one. Number two, I don't know any offense where somebody, if you pretend to be sworn in, that is reasonable. Second, that Twitter message shows a number of other Ugandans present. So you say they should all have been charged with treason, for conspiracy to commit treason. Why only he was picked up in treason? That's why the story is not visible, and the government and the police need to explain to the country what exactly is going on.
You are a former justice of the Supreme Court. At this moment, do you think that the judiciary, the legal system, is acting independent of the executive branch, or are they acting in collusion with the executive branch at this moment?
No, really, I can tell you that people believe that the judiciary in Uganda is not independent. It has not been independent for some time. Many of us have talked publicly, we have written articles.
George Kanyihamba is a former justice of the Ugandan Supreme Court. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. According to Human Rights Watch, the imprisonment of 17 activists in Angola reflects both a growing tendency of authorities to clamp down on freedom of expression in Angola and the country's inadequate prison system. Last month, the Angolan court sentenced 17 activists to between 2 and 8 years in prison after finding them guilty of preparing a rebellion. Zenaida Machado, a researcher at Human Rights Watch's Africa Division, tells Ricky Stryak that in addition, the two female activists in prison were recently physically assaulted by fellow prisoners.
These are 17 Angolan activists who were sentenced to between 2 to 8.5 years in jail for preparing a rebellion. It's the group of academic students and artists were arrested in June following book clubs in which they were discussing, among other things, the democracy in the country. The period the president has been in power, has been in power for 37 years now. And they were also discussing how to organize a peaceful protest. When the trial began, they were initially charged with the crimes of preparatory acts of rebellion and plotting against the president and state institutions. And in a very strange move, towards the end of the trial, the public prosecutor decided to drop the charge of plotting against the president and introduced a new one, which was a criminal conspiracy. And it was exactly for this new charge that they were giving such tough sentence of up to 8.5 years in jail.
These activists who are being sent to prisons, is there a concern that these prisons are overcrowded?
I think the Angolan authorities themselves have recognized that there is a problem with their prison system. It's overcrowded, it lacks basic conditions, like, for example, drinking water or enough food to feed the inmates. The Angolan authorities have several times expressed their frustration with the amount of money that is spent to keep people in jail. And the frustrating thing about that is that many of the people who are in jail are there for reasons that they should not be. So there are several cases of arbitrary arrests.
You mentioned that there's been an uptick recently of arrests of activists. Do you think this has anything to do with the elections being announced, that there will be elections in 2017, even though Dos Santos has not made it clear, I understand, whether he will run again or not?
I think the issue of Angolan authorities not allowing people to demonstrate their anger or insatisfaction with the system or expressing their rights to freedom of assembly or freedom to protest, it comes from many, many years ago. It is unfortunate that it got worse after the 2012 elections. It seems that it's getting worse as we approach next year's elections. I wouldn't be able to give you evidence on how this current situation is interconnected with the upcoming elections. But what I can say is that at some point it will affect on the results of that election, because if those who don't believe in the system in place are not allowed to exercise their right to say that, then you begin to question the validity of any results that will come up from the 2017 election.
That was Zinaida Machado, a researcher with Human Rights Watch's Africa Division. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with rugby. South Africa beat Australia 17-7 to win the plate category at the penultimate tournament in the IRB 7 series in the French capital Paris on Sunday. Australia earlier dismissed Kenya 26-7 in the plate semi-final. In handball, Egypt's Zamalek pipped Tunisian defending champions Esperance 26-25 to win the men's contest at the Africa Handball Cup Winners' Cup Championship in Laayoun, Morocco on Saturday. Tunisia's Hammamet pipped Egypt's Heliopolis 32-31 to clinch the bronze medal. Angolan defending champions Primero de Agosto outclassed Cameroon's Tonnerres Yaounde 40-16 to retain the women's trophy, while Angola's Progresso edged Cameroon's military side FAP 33-30 to earn the bronze medal. In football, Senegal's Fatma Diouf Samora is the new FIFA Secretary General. FIFA President Gianni Infantino announced at the FIFA Congress in the Mexican capital, Mexico City. Samora has 21 years' experience serving in the United Nations across the African continent. She's currently the UN's resident coordinator and United Nations Development Programme representative in Nigeria. Samora is expected to assume office at FIFA next month. In athletics, Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon clocked 3 minutes and 56.82 seconds to run the world's quickest time in women's 1500 meters this year at the IWF Diamond League in Shanghai, China on Friday night. What's more, this is a new Kenya record and meet record. Returning from maternity break, Kenyan Hellen Obiri was runner-up ahead of Ethiopian Dawit Seyaum. Kenyan world champion Hyvin Kiyeng prevailed in women's 3,000 meters steeplechase in 9 minutes and 7.42 seconds, the world's quickest time this year and a new meet record. Ivory Coast's sprinter Muriela Hore triumphed in the women's 200 meters with a 22.72 seconds effort. In men's events, Ethiopian Mukhtar Edris clocked 12 minutes and 59.96 seconds, the world's quickest time in men's 5,000 meters this year. Uganda's world junior 10,000 meter champion Joshua Cheptegei was second ahead of Kenyan Thomas Longosiwa. Ferguson Rotich clocked 1 minute and 45.68 seconds to lead Robert Biwott and Alfred Kipketer in a 1-2-3 Kenyan sweep in the men's 800 meters. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that is it for this Monday, May 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with all of our engineers. I'm James Barton in Washington saying, Africa, you have a very productive week.